Chapter 67. Monarch, there never were such profligate times in England as under Charles II. Whenever you see his portrait, with his swarthy ill-looking face and great nose, you may fancy him in his court at Whitehall, surrounded by some of the very worst vagabonds in the kingdom, though they were lords and ladies, drinking, gambling, indulging in vicious conversation, and committing every kind of profligate excess. It has been a fashion to call Charles II the Merry Monarch. Apostrophe, let me try to give you a general idea of some of the merry things that were done in the merry days when this merry gentleman sat upon his merry throne in merry England. The first merry proceeding was of course to declare that he was one of the greatest, the wisest, and the noblest kings that ever shone, like the blessed sun itself, on this benighted earth. The next merry and pleasant piece of business was for the Parliament, in the humblest manner, to give him £1,200,000 a year, and to settle upon him for life that old disputed tonnage and poundage which had been so bravely fought for. Then, General Monk being made Earl of Albemarle, and a few other royalists similarly rewarded, the law went to work to see what was to be done to those persons they were called regicides, who had been concerned in making a martyr of the late king. 10 of these were merrily executed. That is to say, 6 of the judges, 1 of the council, Colonel Hacker and another officer who had commanded the guards, and Hugh Peters, a preacher who had preached against the martyr with all his heart. These executions were so extremely merry that every horrible circumstance which Cromwell had abandoned was revived with appalling cruelty. The hearts of the sufferers were torn out of their living bodies, their bowels were burned before their faces, the executioner cut jokes to the next victim, as he rubbed his filthy hands together, that were reeking with the blood of the last, and the heads of the dead were drawn on sledges with the living to the place of suffering. Still, even so merry a monarch could not force one of these dying men to say that he was sorry for what he had done. Nay, the most memorable thing said among them was, that if the thing were to do again they would do it. Sir Harry Vane, who had furnished the evidence against Strafford, and was one of the most staunch of the Republicans, was also tried, found guilty, and ordered for execution. When he came upon the scaffold on Tower Hill, after conducting his own defense with great power, his notes of what he had meant to say to the people were torn away from him, and the drums and trumpets were ordered to sound lustily and drown his voice. For, the people had been so much impressed by what the regicides had calmly said with their last breath, that it was the custom now to have the drums and trumpets always under the scaffold, ready to strike up. Vane said no more than this. It is a bad cause which cannot bear the words of a dying man, and bravely died. These merry scenes were succeeded by another, perhaps even merrier. On the anniversary of the late king's death, the bodies of Oliver Cromwell, Ireton, and Bradshaw were torn out of their graves in Westminster Abbey, dragged to Tyburn, hanged there on a gallows all day long, and then beheaded. Imagine the head of Oliver Cromwell set upon a pole, to be stared at by a brutal crowd, not one of whom would have dared to look the living Oliver in the face for half a moment. Think, after you have read this reign, what England was under Oliver Cromwell who was torn out of his grave, and what it was under this merry monarch who sold it, like a merry Judas, over and over again. Of course, the remains of Oliver's wife and daughter were not to be spared either, though they had been most excellent women. The base clergy of that time gave up their bodies, which had been buried in the abbey, and to the eternal disgrace of England they were thrown into a pit, together with the mouldering bones of Pym, and of the brave and bold old Admiral Blake. The clergy acted this disgraceful part, because they hoped to get the nonconformists, or dissenters, thoroughly put down in this reign, and to have but one prayer book and one service for all kinds of people, no matter what their private opinions were. This was pretty well, I think, for a Protestant church, which had displaced the Romish church, because people had a right to their own opinions in religious matters. However, they carried it with a high hand, and a prayer book was agreed upon, in which the extremist opinions of Archbishop Laud were not forgotten. An act was passed to preventing any dissenter from holding any office under any corporation. So, the regular clergy in their triumph were soon as merry as the king. The army being by this time disbanded, and the king crowned, everything was to go on easily forevermore. I must say a word here about the king's family. He had not been long upon the throne, when his brother the Duke of Gloucester, and his sister the Princess of Orange, died within a few months of each other, of smallpox. His remaining sister, the Princess Henrietta, married the Duke of Orleans, the brother of Louis XIV, King of France. His brother James, Duke of York, was made High Admiral, and by became a Catholic. He was a gloomy, sullen, bilious sort of man, with a remarkable partiality for the ugliest women in the country. He married, under very discreditable circumstances, Anne Hyde, the daughter of Lord Clarendon, then the king's principal minister, not at all a delicate minister either, but doing much of the dirty work of a very dirty palace. It became important now that the king himself should be married, and divers foreign monarchs, not very particular about the character of their son-in-law, proposed their daughters to him. The King of Portugal offered his daughter, Catherine of Braganza, and £50,000. In addition to which, the French king, who was favorable to that match, offered a loan of another £50,000. The King of Spain, on the other hand, offered anyone out of a dozen of princesses, and other hopes of gain. But the ready money carried the day, and Catherine came over in state to her merry marriage. The whole court was a great flaunting crowd of debauched men and shameless women, and Catherine's merry husband insulted and outraged her in every possible way, until she consented to receive those worthless creatures as her very good friends, and to degrade herself by their companionship. A Mrs. Palmer, whom the king made Lady Castlemaine, and afterwards Duchess of Cleveland, was one of the most powerful of the bad women about the court, and had great influence with the king nearly all through his reign. Another merry lady named Moll Davies, a dancer at the theater, was afterwards her rival. So was Nell Gwynn, first an Orange girl, and then an actress, who really had good in her, and of whom one of the worst things I know is, that actually she does seem to have been fond of the king. The first Duke of Street, Albans, was this Orange girl's child. In like manner the son of a merry waiting lady, whom the king created Duchess of Portsmouth, became the Duke of Richmond. Upon the whole it is not so bad a thing to be a commoner. The merry monarch was so exceedingly merry among these merry ladies, and some equally merry and equally infamous lords and gentlemen, that he soon got through his £100,000, and then, by way of raising a little pocket money, made a merry bargain. He sold Dunkirk to the French king for 5 millions of livres. When I think of the dignity to which Oliver Cromwell raised England in the eyes of foreign powers, and when I think of the manner in which he gained for England this very Dunkirk, I am much inclined to consider that, if the merry monarch had been made to follow his father for this action, he would have received his just deserts. Though he was like his father in none of that father's greater qualities, he was like him in being worthy of no trust. When he sent that letter to the Parliament, from Breda, he did expressly promise that all sincere religious opinions should be respected. Yet he was no sooner firm in his power than he consented to one of the worst acts of Parliament ever passed. Under this law, every minister who should not give his solemn assent to the prayer book by a certain day, was declared to be a minister no longer, and to be deprived of his church. The consequence of this was that some 2,000 honest men were taken from their congregations, and reduced to dire poverty and distress. It was followed by another outrageous law, called the Conventicle Act, by which any person above the age of 16 who was present at any religious service not according to the prayer book, was to be imprisoned 3 months for the first offense, 6 for the second, and to be transported for the third. This act alone filled the prisons, which were then most dreadful dungeons, to overflowing. The Covenanters in Scotland had already fared no better. A base parliament, usually known as the Drunken Parliament, in consequence of its principal members being seldom sober, had been got together to make laws against the Covenanters, and to force all men to be of one mind in religious matters. The Marquis of Argyll, relying on the king's honor, had given himself up to him, but he was wealthy, and his enemies wanted his wealth. He was tried for treason, on the evidence of some private letters in which he had expressed opinions as well he might more favorable to the government of the late Lord Protector than of the present merry and religious king. He was executed, as were two men of mark among the Covenanters. And Sharp, a traitor who had once been the friend of the Presbyterians and betrayed them, was made Archbishop of St. Andrews, to teach the Scotch how to like bishops. Things being in this merry state at home, the merry monarch undertook a war with the Dutch, principally because they interfered with an African company, established with the two objects of buying gold dust and slaves, of which the Duke of York was a leading member. After some preliminary hostilities, the said Duke sailed to the coast of Holland with a fleet of 98 vessels of war, and 4 fire ships. This engaged with the Dutch fleet, of no fewer than 113 ships. In the great battle between the two forces, the Dutch lost 18 ships, 4 admirals, and 7,000 men. But the English on shore were in no mood of exultation when they heard the news. For this was the year and the time of the great plague in London. During the winter of 1664 it had been whispered about that some few people had died here and there of the disease called the plague, in some of the unwholesome suburbs around London. News was not published at that time as it is now, and some people believed these rumors, and some disbelieved them, and they were soon forgotten. But, in the month of May, 1665, it began to be said all over the town that the disease had burst out with great violence in St. Giles, and that the people were dying in great numbers. This soon turned out to be awfully true. The roads out of London were choked up by people endeavoring to escape from the infected city, and large sums were paid for any kind of conveyance. The disease soon spread so fast that it was necessary to shut up the houses in which sick people were, and to cut them off from communication with the living. Every one of these houses was marked on the outside of the door with a red cross, and the words, "Lord, have mercy upon us." The streets were all deserted, grass grew in the public ways, and there was a dreadful silence in the air. When night came on, dismal rumblings used to be heard, and these were the wheels of the death carts, attended by men with veiled faces, and holding cloths to their mouths, who rang doleful bells and cried in a loud and solemn voice, "Bring out your dead!" The corpses put into these carts were buried by torchlight in great pits, no service being performed over them, all men being afraid to stay for a moment on the brink of the ghastly graves. In the general fear, children ran away from their parents, and parents from their children. Some who were taken ill, died alone, and without any help. Some were stabbed or strangled by hired nurses who robbed them of all their money, and stole the very beds on which they lay. Some went mad, dropped from the windows, ran through the streets, and in their pain and frenzy flung themselves into the river. These were not all the horrors of the time. The wicked and dissolute, in wild desperation, sat in the tavern singing roaring songs, and were stricken as they drank, and went out and died. The fearful and superstitious persuaded themselves that they saw supernatural sights, burning swords in the sky, gigantic arms and darts. Others pretended that at night's vast crowds of ghosts walked round and round the dismal pits. One madman, naked, and carrying a brazier full of burning coals upon his head, stalked through the streets, crying out that he was a prophet, commissioned to denounce the vengeance of the Lord on wicked London. Another always went to and fro, exclaiming, "Yet 40 days, and London shall be destroyed." A third awoke the echoes in the dismal streets, by night and by day, and made the blood of the sick run cold, by calling out incessantly, in a deep hoarse voice, "Oh, the great and dreadful God!" Through the months of July and August and September, the great plague raged more and more. Great fires were lighted in the streets, in the hope of stopping the infection. But there was a plague of rain too, and it beat the fires out. At last, the winds which usually arise at that time of the year which is called the equinox, when day and night are of equal length all over the world, began to blow, and to purify the wretched town. The deaths began to decrease, the red crosses slowly to disappear, the fugitives to return, the shops to open, pale frightened faces to be seen in the streets. The plague had been in every part of England, but in close and unwholesome London it had killed 100,000 people. All this time, the merry monarch was as merry as ever, and as worthless as ever. All this time, the debauched lords and gentlemen and the shameless ladies danced and gamed and drank, and loved and hated one another according to their merry ways. So little humanity did the government learn from the late affliction, that one of the first things the Parliament did, when it met at Oxford, being as yet afraid to come to London, was to make a law, called the 5 Mile Act, expressly directed against those poor ministers who, in the time of the plague, had manfully come back, to comfort the unhappy people. This infamous law, by forbidding them to teach in any school, or to come within 5 miles of any city, town, or village, doomed them to starvation and death. The fleet had been at sea, and healthy. The King of France was now in alliance with the Dutch, though his navy was chiefly employed in looking on while the English and Dutch fought. The Dutch gained one victory, and the English gained another and a greater. And Prince Rupert, one of the English admirals, was out in the Channel one windy night, looking for the French admiral, with the intention of giving him something more to do than he had had yet, when the gale increased to a storm, and blew him into St. Helens. That night was the 3rd of September, 1666, and that wind fanned the great fire of London. It broke out at a baker's shop near London Bridge, on the spot on which the monument now stands as a remembrance of those raging flames. It spread and spread, and burned, for 3 days. The nights were lighter than the days. In the daytime there was an immense cloud of smoke, and in the nighttime there was a great tower of fire mounting up into the sky, which lighted the whole country landscape for 10 miles round. Showers of hot ashes rose into the air, and fell on distant places. Flying sparks carried the conflagration to great distances, and kindled it in 20 new spots at a time. Church steeples fell down with tremendous crashes. Houses crumbled into cinders by the hundred and the thousand. The summer had been intensely hot and dry, the streets were very narrow, and the houses mostly built of wood and plaster. Nothing could stop the tremendous fire, but the want of more houses to burn, nor did it stop until the whole way from the tower to Temple Bar was a desert, composed of the ashes of 13,000 houses and 89 churches. This was a terrible visitation at the time, and occasioned great loss and suffering to the 200,000 burnt-out people, who were obliged to lie in the fields under the open night sky, or in hastily made huts of mud and straw, while the lanes and roads were rendered impassable by carts which had broken down as they tried to save their goods. But the fire was a great blessing to the city afterwards. For it arose from its ruins very much improved, built more regularly, more widely, more cleanly and carefully. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.